Petersfield's Shine Radio.
Well, I'm really lucky to be at my favourite place, Butser Ancient Farm, and I'm here with Trevor Crichton. And Trevor, would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yes, thanks. I'm an archaeologist. I'm actually an experimental archaeologist. So what that means is an experimental archaeologist designs experiments to test ideas and theories that we have about people living in the past. What we do at Butser is to test ideas about how houses were built. We have a lot of houses here which range in date from the Neolithic, which is about 6,000, 6,500 years ago, all the way through to the Anglo-Saxon period, so that's around 1,300 years ago.
So what are we actually looking at now? I mean, I must say we're sitting on luxury armchairs. Where are we?
We're sitting in the middle of the framework of what's going to be a Bronze Age roundhouse. At the moment, it has no roof. It has only partial walls. It has a lot of posts with horizontal timbers on top. But trust me, this is the framework for a Bronze Age roundhouse.
That looks like it's been repurposed, because that one over there, I think that's just luck, but it looks as if it's got really exotic carving in it.
It would be nice, but actually that's just some sort of parasitic worm, I think, that's got underneath the bark of that tree trunk while it's been lying around seasoning. But it does look rather like Neolithic or Bronze Age.
I think that's serendipitous. I would use that. I would paint it or something.
I think that that's really plausible. People must have taken cues for abstract artwork from somewhere. When I say abstract artwork, I mean we see in 40,000 year old pictures, we see really beautiful pictures that clearly represent species like gazelle and aurochs, which is a large type of cattle, and all sorts of things that are clearly recognisable as wildlife. But in the Neolithic, in the Bronze Age and in the Iron Age, and to this very day, we still have abstract patterns that we can't understand. Often they're spirals. And why not? Why not imitate the world around you? Why not make some reference to that? There is an alternative theory that a lot of the spiral patterns, just like those worms over there, were actually the result of hallucinogenic experiences.
Oh!
So there's been some experimental work done on the effects.
Are we going to experiment with any today?
No, we're not going to do that. This is definitely not that sort of place.
I like to think with spirals that that's also infinity. And so
yeah.
And I'm just book three, which I've mentioned, the listeners know that I've bored the listeners with book three long enough, really. But you don't know, Trevor, that I'm writing about the Vikings, or, you know, it's a Viking thriller. And one of the things is on Newgrange, they've got, like the Isle of Man, the Triskelion.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that a lot, which is like three spirals.
Yeah. And that's a really persistent pattern. You see that in Iron Age art, what we often call Celtic art, that Triskelion repeats. And then we have to wonder, as was suggested to me, is the coat of arms of the Isle of Man and also of Sicily, are those derived from these ancient forms of abstract representation? I'm not saying that they are, but it's a really interesting lineage. And the other thing that strikes me is perhaps these somehow represent the cosmos, as it's understood. Because Newgrange, as I'm sure you will know, is a sort of astronomical clock. The rear of Newgrange lights up at a certain time of year, which I think is the winter solstice.
I think it is. I think that winter sun just coming through.
Yes, right through a little gap and lights the back wall.
Incredible.
Stonehenge is, of course, an astronomical timepiece. So we're dealing with people who are not primitive. They're thoroughly modern, and that's something that's worth emphasising. Our species, Homo sapiens, have been around for 200 to 300,000 years. So when we're going back into relatively recent times, 4,000 or 6,000 years ago, we're dealing with people like you and me. If you gave them a shave, gave them a modern set of clothes, put them on the bus, or probably the women you wouldn't have to shave, but we don't know, they would be just like you and I. So they are as intelligent as we are, and they had clearly a knowledge of the cosmos. So perhaps this is a way of their representing the seasons, the cycles, the cosmos as they understood it. The beauty is we don't know. But that's actually one of the wonderful things about archaeology. We can try and fill in those gaps. It's an imaginative activity. We often tend to characterise it as a science, and there is a lot of science in archaeology, but ultimately, when we're trying to extract the life stories, the way people live, there is a large leap of the imagination that's required. So I love that idea that we can tell stories through these ancient symbols.
I was going to say, it's so close to storytelling, yeah. Which I think, in a way, we all do about our own lives.
Yes,
even,
yes.
You know?
Well, slightly at a tangent, but I think it's related. We built a large Neolithic house, which is a late Stone Age house. And when we were building it, we were using Stone Age tools, particularly flint axes. So they're hafted onto a piece of wood, and they're a lovely shaped flint head, very effective
tool.
Was
that for authenticity or a learning thing as well?
Authenticity, really.
Okay.
We weren't trying to be experts in Neolithic carpentry, which we know a surprising lot about, and there are those people who excel in it. What we were trying to do was say, okay, we're a group of people without particular skills. We're not tradespeople. We can imagine that small Neolithic communities didn't have tradespeople. They didn't have specialists. They probably had people with more advanced skills than we have because of their experience. But we can't think of them as having tradespeople they can call upon. So what we decided to do was test whether we, as novices, could create a structure that would support a roof on a building that's 15 metres long and 5 metres wide.
It's a big roof.
7 metres, sorry, wide. It is. And we were successful. But one of the really fascinating things was when we were cutting these little notches in the logs for our joints, the logs were suspended just above the ground on some timber work. So they were sitting, say, a foot above the ground. And as you hit them with the axe, they reverberate. They're like a very tight drum. But then when you get 3 or 4 people doing this, it's sort of asynchronous. So you get this wonderful syncopated music out of it. And the penny really dropped for me. I thought, well, is this the origin of music?
That's fascinating.
It's really wonderful. You know, I can't say that that's how music originated, but you can imagine. It was so appealing to me. I wasn't thinking going to sit here and listen for the origins of music. The penny just dropped. It just occurs. This is wonderful. You know, it's a wonderful immersive soundscape. And why wouldn't you try and replicate that in a musical form?
Certainly you could say that rhythm's written into us.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say from the mother's heartbeat or something.
Yes.
That certainly, whatever it was, gave you as much pleasure as a modern man.
Yes.
As you can imaginatively definitely think that they would have liked it.
Yes, yes, I think so. And it was just so enjoyable. Not, as I say, from a scientific perspective, but purely from a human perspective.
Yeah. And you can only do that by doing it.
Yes, you can. And that's one of the beauties of experimental archaeology, is this sort of serendipitous discovery. So the experiment is conceived in a sort of scientific manner. We have a problem and we're going to devise an experiment to test it. That's familiar to any scientist. But there's another component to what we do, which we call experiential archaeology. And that is that sort of thing where you gain some knowledge out of a sort of bodily or a tactile experience of thing. And very often it's not the knowledge you think is out there, it's things like that. So the experience of building these structures and doing these experiments using authentic tools is itself instructive and very enjoyable.
That's brilliant. Well, Trevor and I are just going to walk round over to the Bronze Age. I don't know what to call it at this stage, really. What would you call it? A roundhouse in fetus.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
We're going to walk over there.
A nascent roundhouse.
A nascent. I love it. You see, I've got the mother thing.
No, that's
thing
a perfect
going
analogy
on.
As well.
There you go. Trevor and I are within the Bronze Age structure. And so, Trevor, we talked about the Neolithic and why you built that, what lessons had to be learned. So why Bronze Age and what lessons have you learned from building this?
There are a number of reasons we're building a Bronze Age structure. The first of those is that on our site we have Neolithic buildings, we have Iron Age buildings, and that means that we've just jumped over about 1,500 very, very important years.
Ooh.
So the Bronze Age is an incredibly important part of prehistory. I rather romantically seeing it see it as being the dawn, the sort of evanescence of the modern world, for all that is good and bad about that. So it's an important chronological gap that we want to fill. But the project itself also serves some really interesting experimental ends, because this house is based on some archaeology that was excavated at a place called Dunch Hill. Dunch Hill is on MOD land on Salisbury Plain, which will lead me to another story. But for the moment, what we recovered there were about 10 post holes, the evidence of where 10 posts had stood.
Circular.
In form, roughly circular.
So I sound intelligent, but I'm sitting within a circle, so it's not that bright of me.
This is not the most regular of roundhouses, but it's identifiably a roundhouse, because roundhouses are quite common in archaeology, all the way from the Bronze Age, even the late Neolithic, through to beyond the coming of Roman Britain.
Is that because they're a stable structure or something?
Well, that's a big question. Yeah.
I honestly don't know the answer.
That's a whole other podcast. Well, actually, I want to write a book called Why Are Roundhouses Round? The short answer, and the one you most commonly get in from archaeologists, is that they are a very simple structure to build a strong house from, or a strong building from. You don't need jointing, and you don't need to worry about corners. So if you don't have complicated jointing like they had in medieval buildings, or you don't have mechanised processes of making metal fastenings as you do with modern houses, or concrete or brick, you're really building a house of cards. A rectangular house just wants to fall down. It needs to be braced in quite well-engineered ways. Roundhouses don't. Roundhouses are fairly freestanding. So long as you build a reasonable base, what you end up is a big drum, and you put a cone on the top of it, and it's quite amazingly self-supporting as a structure. It also has the huge advantage of performing rather like a lighthouse. So they learnt, I think, in the 17th century or thereabouts, not to build square lighthouses because they get pushed over. So any fluid, a water or air is a fluid, that pushes on the side of a rectangle just keeps pushing on the side of it. So you take that, you take away your square lighthouse, you build a circular lighthouse, and the fluid flows around it.
That's as brilliant.
It does a roundhouse. So they're super efficient
Never
structures.
Thought of that.
Yeah. Now that is what I would call the functionalist answer that you get from most archaeologists, and I think it's a good answer. The real mystery is, why do they occur everywhere in Britain and Ireland, but not across the Channel in northern France, what's now, of course, northern France, or west coast of Germany, or the Low Countries, or Scandinavia? To the best of my knowledge, there has not been a single roundhouse found there. There's lots of prehistoric houses, but they're all rectangular. You do, however, find roundhouses in Brittany and Normandy. You also find them in Galicia and down around the southern Mediterranean coast.
And African huts.
In Africa as well. They're a structure that people have struck upon in isolation all around the world because they're a good structure. But I find it really interesting that they occur on this, what's called the Atlantic fringe, of which Britain and Ireland are part. Do roundhouses occur in Britain for cultural reasons? Because we know that there was a lot of trade between Britain and what we now call Normandy and Brittany
in the late Stone Age. But so there was with Vikings.
Yes, but by the time the Vikings had come, the Romans had already been here.
Oh, yeah.
So buildings from around the era of about 400 AD, roundhouses seem to go out of use. They persist longer than that in Ireland and probably in Scotland as well, but everyone starts to adopt a rectangular building. And with the coming of the Anglo-Saxons, whatever that might mean, the buildings by that time almost exclusively appear to be rectangular. So the roundhouse is a fascinating thing in its own right.
Shall I tell you what I invented? And you can
yes.
tell me whether it's rubbish or not.
Yes.
And I can tell you, Trevor's going to be honest, is that precisely the Vikings went over to Dublin and came across round structures
yeah.
of the ancients that they had built, and they found this peculiar. And I invented that it was because of their belief system in Ireland that evil spirits lurked in corners, so they didn't want corners in any of their buildings, which my Vikings thought, actually, that's not daft, but well, we don't know how to do that, so let's just carry on regardless. Well, what do you think?
I don't have an answer to it definitely, but I like it as an idea. One of the beauties of archaeology is when push comes to shove, each person is about as expert as the other. You can know all sorts of facts about the archaeology of the Iron Age, but as you've never been there, you really don't know what people's ideas were. You can see the traces. You can see, okay, they made iron pots and they cooked in them, or they made beautiful jewellery and they made beautiful hand mirrors. So you get a little bit of an insight into people. They had enough pride in their appearance that they wanted to have a hand mirror. That gives you one delicious little snippet. But what they believed, we have no idea.
But we're all afraid of the dark. Even yes. Now, if we had an outage and we were all reduced to candles for night after night,
yep.
I think within about a fortnight we'd all be believing in zombies and things.
Yeah. And there is a suggestion that some of the... there are small holes in that you find in Anglo-Saxon buildings. They're triangular. I think they're called wind eyes, which is where window comes from. But don't quote me on that. One suggestion is, and it may have been documented, I'm not sure, is that they're to allow evil spirits to pass out. Oh. So we've got some small insight into superstition. And as you say, there's a fine line between superstition and religion, in a sense. And I don't mean that to be disparaging of religion, but what I mean is all religions contain an element of caution that is about not transgressing. So sometimes what we call superstition is just a way almost of denigrating a belief system that came before us.
Yeah.
So I buy into that. And interestingly enough, the University College Dublin have built their own roundhouse, and I believe it's a Viking era roundhouse.
Oh.
I can't tell you if it was inhabited by Vikings, but it's from that period.
Oh, how
that
interesting.
Period. Yeah.
Because Sarah Moss, the author who wrote Ghost Wall, who
yep.
very much to do with Bronze Age and reenactment and things like that, it's a wonderful book, has gone over and she's a lecturer in creative writing over
really?
There. So she's moved over there. Yeah. So that's fascinating.
Yes.
Great book. I'm down linking to my Talking Books podcast, I know. But if you haven't read Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss, please do.
Now, that sort of segues me into something else, which is a bit of a digression. I was going to say
no,
transgression, but
we
hopefully
like it.
Not.
No, we like digressions.
Near here, there's a very important Anglo-Saxon site called Churchdown. It is the site from which we have taken the archaeology and built two buildings from. But it's built in close association with 13 Bronze Age round barrows. Usually they're used for burials. And this is actually very common in this early to middle Anglo-Saxon period, is to build buildings near Bronze Age monuments, particularly these barrows. Sometimes they're Neolithic, and sometimes Iron Age, but very often around these round barrows, which are really just round lumps in the ground, well known in Petersfield from the Heath.
Mm.
Of course, even in the period of the Anglo-Saxons, and certainly in prehistory, they would have been much bigger. What we've seen is a sort of eroded and often ploughed evidence of what's left. So there is this association between that Anglo-Saxon period and the Bronze Age, which is not explained, of course, because we don't know. We don't have documentary evidence. But it appears to me to have some connection to belief, because the Anglo-Saxons will often reuse the Bronze Age burial mounds for their own burials. In fact, they sometimes create some of their own. So it suggests to me a spiritual connection of some sort, or an ancestral connection of some sort, which is a little puzzling, given that the Anglo-Saxons are not supposed to have come from Britain. They're supposed to have come from Western Germany and the Low Countries. But there is that connection there. What we now call superstition or spiritualism, or whatever you want to call it, is probably a belief system that we now want to denigrate a little bit. And on that subject, and I'll try and end my digression here.
No, we like it.
But there was a wonderful book called Perceptions of the Prehistoric in the Anglo-Saxon World. And it's by a woman called Sarah Semple, who's an archaeologist. And she documents a lot of these sites. And what she has found is that a lot of these earlier sites have name changes with the coming of Christianity to the Anglo-Saxon world. So what we now call the Devil's Dykes and the Devil Jumps were probably Woden's Dykes and Woden's Jumps, or Thor's Dykes or Thor's Jumps.
Right.
So what you see there, I think, is a sort of usurpation of a religious belief. So what you do is you literally demonise places that were once holy, once spiritually powerful, by changing the name, changing them to devils.
I like that. So if you can't assimilate, if there's something you can't assimilate, like Easter, and make that useful, you'll then denigrate it.
Yes.
I love that. And I also wonder about topography, though, because I wonder if there is, you know, like the Jungian thing with beliefs and so on, and objects and so on. I wonder if there's a kind of a place, well, I think we all feel it, don't you, listening at home? Aren't there places that you go into and you have a good or a bad feel about? And we can't explain it. Here we are, so modern with our iPhones and our GPS and everything. But you go in some places and just want to go out.
So much so that that's always been a prerequisite of my house investigation. Where I'm thinking of moving to a place, I'll just go there and be there. And I've made determinations at least a couple of times that I'm not living here, that doesn't have the right vibe. So yes, I agree with that completely. Terribly unscientific of, but there it is.
No.
It works for me.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, you can't prove a negative with what would happen. I am fascinated by burial. And I said to you before we started recording, I said to Trevor, I'm fascinated by burial. Now, I'm published by Unbound, and one of our authors is Francis Pryor.
Yeah. Well-known. Bronze Age specialist.
Is he? I didn't know he was a Bronze Age specialist.
He's a prehistorian, but I think his great love is the Bronze Age.
Okay. I asked him about burial because of this book three being slightly set at Newgrange sort of thing. But I also, even in book two, Obsidian, I wanted to reference how to make bodies safe when you could no longer burn them because you haven't got trees anymore. So I go back to Iceland lots. Everybody listening knows that because I bore them with them nearly weekly. And he was really kind enough to tell me about beheadings. Now, has he just stringing me along as a fellow author, or what do you know about beheadings of corpses to keep them safe in the ground? And would that be Bronze Age, or is that pre-Bronze Age?
I know them from the Iron Age. That's post-Bronze Age.
Post-Bronze Age.
So the Bronze Age, to give it some context, the Bronze Age runs from around 3000 in Britain, from around 3,500 years ago to around 2,800 years ago. And that then morphs into the Iron Age. And I say morphs because, of course, you know, it's not, Wednesday afternoon, 3:30, it's time for the Iron Age. It doesn't work like that. The interesting thing about that is if we want to locate that, the pyramids in Egypt are built at the dawn of the British Bronze Age. The Stonehenge, as we recognise it now, it's a very long-lived monument that was modified over many centuries. But its final form, and the one that we recognise it as, was in the Bronze Age. That took place in the early Bronze Age. The Battle of Troy, Odysseus, they took place to the extent that we think they might have some factuality, and certainly the Athenians regarded them as being factual. That's a Bronze Age epic. So lots of things that
lots
and writing. Not in Britain. We don't see any writing until the Romans come. That's definitely identifiable. But in Sumeria and Egypt, it's the birth of writing, which again is what's such an important and transformative time. But I know beheadings from the Iron Age in Britain. The head seems to have had something of a cult status. So I can well imagine that to remove the power from someone, to cut off their head, would be a way to do it. There is a suggestion, and suggested by the Romans, and I think there's some evidence to back this up, that Iron Age warriors, the people who are commonly called Celts, but archaeologists don't like that term for some good and some maybe not so good reasons, but
let's go with Celt.
Let's go with that, because it's recognisable. They sometimes suggest that they're headhunters, or their warriors were headhunters, so they would take the heads of victims and display them. That suggests that the heads were potent symbols, it wasn't necessarily just that they were recognisable, but they had real potency. There are lots of heads found in a Roman level under London. It was turned up during the excavation for the Crossrail. Found lots of heads underneath there, or skulls, I should say.
Were they arranged or
no?
Just
I
random?
Don't think so. I think
right,
they were.
But there were just lots of heads.
But they date to around the time of the Boudiccan Revolt. Boudica or Boadicea, call her what you will.
Or Boudica. There was a phase for Boudica.
Yeah, Boudica is still.
I grew up with Boadicea.
Yeah, Boadicea was a sort of Victorianism. They like to give it that. But either we know who she was. Doesn't matter which name we use. Yes.
I'm thinking of an individual in his or her coffin with the head placed between the long thigh bones and sometimes a stone in the mouth.
I have heard of that form of burial, but I can't remember where I've heard of it from.
Probably Francis Pryor.
Iron Age... Iron Age, I believe, I've heard of that burial from the Iron Age period, although the Knights Templar buried in something of a similar way. So
did
the
they?
Pirate flag of the skull and crossbones
yes.
is somewhat derived from the Templars' burial practices, or so the story goes.
Oh, I like that
yes.
too. Oh, you see, everything's linked.
Well,
only connect.
I may be off track there, but
no,
it is something
I like
I've
all this. Once. I mean, we like all this, don't we? The next chunk I'm going to be asking Trevor is about the earth walls.
Rise and shine with Petersfield's Shine Radio.
Rise and shine.
Whatever local information comes in, you'll be the very first to know.
You'll feel those ribs expand. And
okay, I'm doing it. I'm doing
are
it.
Are you doing it?
Yeah.
Well, welcome back to Rise and Shine. You're with Alan Cott this morning.
What could be better?
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
I'm Harrison RB. It's the brighter way to start your day in the Petersphere.
As long as you're breathing, you're doing okay.
I'm so, with you, Vicky.
Rise and Shine, weekday mornings from 6 with Petersfield's Shine Radio.
I think that's lovely.